Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I have of late lost all my mirth, says Hamlet. The earth around him seems sterile. Even the air seems foul and pestilent. It takes the arrival of the players to shake Hamlet from his melancholy. And that is precisely what a few of us should have been doing this month with our own merry band of players. I've adapted Shakespeare's play, Hamlet, for a theatre company from Derry, Stage Beyond. We should be on the road with it now. The company consists of actors with what are called intellectual disabilities, but who, I have quickly learned, have an unusual ability for the stage. They treat the text as absolutely fresh. They or step not the modesty of nature. They perform with real skill and rare joy. That joy is much needed at the moment, and they should have been sharing it, shaking the country from its melancholy. But the first things to close in a pandemic, and perhaps the last to reopen, are the theatres. It has always been thus. The theatre has been haunted by plague since its birth, perhaps because this most social of the arts was uniquely vulnerable to it. 2,450 years ago, Athens was hit by plague. The playwright Sophocles lived through it, and in his play, Oedipus the King, he explained plague as divine punishment for the murder of King Oedipus's predecessor. 2 millennia later, Shakespeare gave us another plagued king, Lear. There was a meme going around at the start of the lockdown, a kind of motivational prompt to productivity during the pestilence. It said, when Shakespeare was quarantined because of the plague, he wrote King Lear. But was it true? I phoned James Shapiro, a Shakespearean scholar at Columbia University in New York, and reached him as he was about to teach a class via Zoom. The meme wasn't true, not literally. King Lear wasn't written during lockdown. But it was written during a period like that into which we are heading, in the wake of an outbreak, amidst the fears that it might return. Between 1603 and 1610, plague returned pretty much every year to London. Their version of today's daily press conferences was the Plague Bill, published weekly. If the bill said there had been more than 30 deaths, a kind of social distancing was enforced and the theatres were closed. Again. Shakespeare never used plague for a plot. You didn't want to be reminding audiences to be afraid of the fellow in the row behind with the cough. But Shapiro has been back combing through the plays, discovering that they are woven through with references to contagion. Like when Lear calls his daughter Regan a plague sore. Ouch. In a sun-kissed Croppy's Acre in Dublin on a recent weekend, I bumped into some theatre pals and we fell to wondering about the bleak prospects for our trade. Even when the theatres can reopen, how will they keep audiences distanced and still sell enough tickets? How will actors rehearse and perform at a social distance? How could you do a love scene, a fight scene, a dance, a hug? In my house, we've turned online for our theatrical hit. We've been to the South Bank in London to see Tamsin Gregg in Twelfth Night at the National and joined an audience from all over the world at a thrilling version of The Tempest, staged live over Zoom from the actors' separate houses by a Northern Irish director, Zoe Seaton. More than 100,000 people checked out the Abbey's Dear Ireland series on YouTube. And our Tragedians of the City of Derry are taking to radio with Hamlet, recording their lines on their phones to be assembled as a radio play for RTE. So the show goes on. Sort of. But none of those brings a group of strangers together in a room to watch another group of people walk across an empty space. Theatre has survived 2,500 years because it answers a need we sometimes don't even know we have, to see our greatest fears and our gravest dilemmas enacted live, on stage, before us. To see our players hold a mirror up to nature. There's a difference between holding up a mirror and holding up a screen. Everybody now is scared about something. And Perhaps my fear is the least of them, that I may not get back to writing for a group of strangers who have come together in an empty space to watch a play. But that fear must have afflicted Shakespeare too, every time his theatre was closed down. And yet, James Shapiro told me, Shakespeare never abandoned London for his second home in Stratford. He knew his audience would want to see plays as soon as the theatres reopened, that they would need to see plays. He was determined to be there to provide them, and he gave his plague-sore audience some of his greatest, most visceral plays, Lear, Coriolanus, Macbeth. That's one of the lessons of Shakespeare's day, Shapiro said. The theatres filled up again, and the playwrights went right back at it. How will we do that? When? I've no idea. Perhaps the best we can do is follow Hamlet once he has shaken off his melancholy. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all.
Ah, he's depressed. Stahl took a powder.
It's a dirty shame.
Yeah.
Well, cheer up.
Just remember what the immortal bard once said.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. Unquote. So remember this.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry.
The late great Con Hulin is reputed to have said that he missed Italia 90 because he was in Italy at the time. I missed it too, but for a different reason. My brother was on secondment in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, and he and his wife invited us to visit them and to explore that beautiful country. For a variety of reasons, the only time we could travel was between mid-June and mid-July 1990. The trip of a lifetime for the family trumped my love of sport, but we expected we'd be able to see the Italia 90 matches on television anyway. In fact, our flights to Zimbabwe were on the 11th of June, the very day Ireland played England in that epic draw in Cagliari. I reckon we were flying over the Mediterranean while the match was taking place. After a few days, my brother and his wife provided us with a car and an itinerary to traverse the country, staying in hotels some of the time, and also in self-catering safari lodges. The car had no radio, and the safari lodges didn't have TV, so our connection with the outside world was patchy, to say the least. We were in the Great Zimbabwe Hotel the following Sunday when the television newsreader simply rolled out the score of that day's match. Ireland nil, Egypt nil, without comment or elaboration. Of course, I knew nothing about Eamon Dunphy's famous or infamous spat with Jack Charlton for weeks afterwards. I found out the result of the match against Holland a day after it happened. And by the time Ireland played Romania, we were staying in a safari park at what was then called Lake McIlwain, now Lake Shaviro, not far from Harare, but we had to be safely back in our house by dark, around 6 in the evening, with no radio or television, isolated from the world. But staying in a nearby cottage were some young English people who had a transistor radio. My impression was they had little interest in football and seemed more into music. But anyway, I'd asked them to let me know the result of the match if by any chance they heard it that night on the radio. We had our evening meal, resigned to not finding out the match result until at least the following day, and sometime later we were encouraging our boys, aged 5 and 9, to head for bed, when we were startled out of our wits by a loud knock at the door. A tall young Englishman and his female friend were standing there. "Pat, do you want to know tonight's result?" I was still getting over the shock of the loud noise, but I could see the glint in his eye and the six-pack under his arm as he nonchalantly said, "Romania 4, Ireland 5. I couldn't believe it. "That has to have been a penalty shootout," I said, incredulous. "Dunno," he said. "The result was given just like that, 5-4, no details, but I think we should celebrate. I was very proud that my first reaction was to think that Packy Bonner would never have let in 4 goals. My second, more unworthy thought was that our forwards were unlikely to score 5. Yet, both those things were to happen within the next 12 months. Packy conceding 4 against Motherwell in a Scottish Cup semi-final replay, and Ireland scoring 5 against Turkey in Lansdowne Road in a Euro 92 qualifier, which I actually attended. That night, we opened a few of the beers the nice Englishman brought and toasted Ireland's success, blissfully unaware of George Hamilton's dramatic words as he described how the nation was holding its breath as Dave O'Leary stepped up to take the decisive penalty, or of the scenes of pandemonium on the field in Genoa, not to mention those throughout Ireland and beyond these shores, as the Irish people celebrated a rare moment of success in the world's most popular field sport. By the time of the quarter-final against Italy, we were in Victoria Falls, where, because it's nearer to Lusaka than Harare, we could only get Zambian TV. There was very little interest in the match there, and it took a hotel worker until the second half to get only mediocre reception on an old black-and-white TV. Sadly, by then, Scilacci had done his work, and despite cheering on Ireland from such a distance with only one bored hotel worker for company, it all seemed an anticlimax. We knew nothing of the amazing homecoming until a week later, when, back in Bulawayo, my brother showed me some of the Irish newspapers he'd received in the post. I soaked up the coverage of Italian 90 and its aftermath, and have continued to do so over the 30 years since then, whether on TV, video, or YouTube. I have to remind myself that I saw none of the amazing exploits of the Irish team in real time. But I do feel like I was there.
We've qualified for the World Cup. Go and compete.
In the autumn of 2019, I moved from the south side to the north side of Dublin and set about exploring my new neighbourhood. Soon I fell in love with being so near the sea, and not long after that, I became intrigued by a local heron. While walking along the Clontarf seafront, I'd see it standing there, silent in the shallows, unmoving. It seemed oblivious to the world around it, and certainly it ignored me every time I fumbled for my phone to take a photo of it. A photo that could never perfectly capture why this bird grew to fascinate me so. It was something to do with this grey heron's refusal to engage with the frenetic pace of everything else around it. No matter that metres away, engines thrummed as cars sped down a main road. No matter the chatter of people walking past. None of that seemed to matter to the heron at all, as it focused on its task of spearing a fish or frog for its dinner. I looked out for my heron every day, and one day I spotted it at the edge of a river that's 15 minutes' walk from the seafront. Or was it a totally different heron? I couldn't be sure. All I knew was that every time I saw the heron, my heart leapt. I decided to presume it was the same heron all the time, that it would choose to stand at the river edge or by the sea, depending on its mood. Grey herons, or Ardea cinerea to give them their proper name, are beautiful birds, but not showy. They're elegant and delicate, with a long, narrow bill and a neck that can curve into an S-shape. They somehow both blend into and stand out from their surroundings, with their grey and white feathered body, which is bookended by a punk rock black crest on the top of their head, and skinny, fragile-seeming yellow legs. When the coronavirus pandemic began to shut Dublin down, I put the bit of extra time I now had into taking up running again. Now I saw more of my heron, and I discovered it lives in the park between the seafront and the river. I discovered too that it likes to wander around the park early in the morning when there aren't many of us humans around. Some lucky days I would spot my heron slowly and delicately picking its way amongst the daffodils. In ancient Egypt, the heron was considered a divine messenger. The deity Bennu was even depicted in the shape of a heron. Bennu, in turn, was a symbol of rebirth. It's not hard to see why the ancient Egyptians held a heron in such great esteem. This strange, calm bird that seems to know more than us humans do about how to exist in the world peacefully. At a time of such strangeness and anxiety, I've lately been turning to the heron to see what I can learn from how it reacts to the world around it. The heron and I are so different. I'm not one for sitting silently, and when I worry about things, I'm prone to being fidgety and unfocused. The heron, if he or she worries at all, never betrays a sign of its internal distress. Why rush seems to be the heron's motto. Yet the world around my heron has changed so much in the past couple of months that I wonder if it has picked up on the tilt and shift of the Dublin city around it. Did it wonder where the lines of buses and cars suddenly went in March? Can it detect fewer exhaust fumes? Has it ever looked to the distance at the cranes that once swung above the skeletons of office blocks and wondered why, for many weeks, they'd stopped moving? Does it notice that there are more people now, in the park at all times of the day, running, walking, avoiding each other? Does it pick up on our fear? I also wonder what the heron would say to me if we had a talk about what's going on. Listen, I tell it, I'm worried right now about the future, about what's in store. What should I do? I imagine it would tell me to take my head out of the future and bring it back into the moment. Because in the moment, there is stillness and there is space. You can carve out a bit of peace for yourself in that moment. Or maybe the heron would turn, fix me with a beady eye and say, hey, I'm trying to catch my dinner here. I had thought the heron to be the epitome of elegance, but it turns out it's not always. While in the park last week, I was engaged in the usual battle of trying to keep running even when I felt like I wanted to stop. Then I heard a strange sound. It was like a person turning their head from side to side while clearing their throat. It sounded gurgly and odd. I looked up, saw the flash of long grey wings and tree branches, and realised it was my heron making the funny juvenile noise. So, I thought, the heron is wise, but the heron isn't perfect. There's a quirky side to it too. And on I kept running, newly energised by my discovery of the bird's idiosyncrasy, and marvelling at how nature throws us these little surprises when we least expect them.
So I go walking on the shore and wonder what I'm walking for. Rain falling in the stream as I try to figure out what it all.
I'm standing on the bridge over the town's river, looking at the modest but crystal clear flow of a few inches of water over the stony bed, just as I would have done when I was 12 years old. It's no Mississippi or Volga, but it's our river on which the town was founded. It was deemed decent enough even for Rory O'Connor, the last High King of Ireland, to have his wonderful castle built near its banks about 850 years ago. When you're growing up, the grandeur of your surroundings isn't of major importance. Your home is your home, its scale a secondary consideration. You don't know any different. To us, Turnadaily Hill was the steepest hill in the world, and Mike McGuff was the world's tallest man. Our shallow river, called the Nanny, runs under this bridge and on through the town, is sidetracked in by the old mill where the wooden wheel has been restored only recently, past the tasteful and solemn little garden where two standing stones remember Anne-Marie McHugh, our town's victim of the Twin Towers attack. Then, on between the builder's yard and the shopping centre, out beneath the main road where it passes the Garda station on the right, and out into the countryside, underneath the railway bridge, after which it joins the River Clare. The Clare flows to Lough Corrib, and the lake empties into the River Corrib, which flows with great gusto and energy through Galway City, and out into the bay and the Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic is connected to every other ocean on the planet. It may seem like a very simple primary school geography lesson, but it's one of the ways by which we understand our connection to the rest of the world. I can remember standing here as a youth, drawn to the lingering sunsets in the western sky at this time of year, and harbouring vague visions and fantasies of a life of travel and adventure to places unknown and even unimaginable, though images on cinema and television screens would have planted some seeds. Growing up the youngest child of parents who had lost their eldest 8-year-old son to a simple but tragic accident the year before I was born influenced my ambitions. I was understandably encouraged to be cautious and careful, even fearful of strangers and the unknown. No climbing trees for me, and cycling and swimming weren't top of the list either. Like perhaps many others, I felt torn between a powerful desire to explore and learn, and my deep fear of the unknown. But gradually, over time, one non-threatening travel experience followed another. The bus to Galway, the tube to Brixton, the subway to 42nd Street. And I grew to not only endure, but enjoy these journeys in the midst of interesting strangers. In the intervening 4 decades, I'm blessed to be able to say that 3 of those decades were filled with exhilarating travel and adventure to countless places around the globe. Not only that, but they happened in a dream come true fashion, coming as a result of doing the thing I loved the most from that age, playing music. And I found that there was no more to fear from the outside world as I went out into it, step by step, than if I'd stayed at home. Legendary playwright Tom Murphy grew up here as well, and when he left to swim in a bigger pond, he said that he had encountered in his hometown every character he needed for a lifetime of writing plays. I imagine most hometowns offer similar raw material. This sunny but cool early summer day, standing once again over the River Nanny, many of my travels are now as far in the past as they were in my 12-year-old's future. Today, my immediate travel range is just about the same as it was back then when we had football training, soccer in the schoolyard, and the snooker hall to keep us occupied. But the time is flying. We're healthy and enjoying the adjusted lifestyle in many ways, developing a new appreciation and knowledge of what's essential and what's not. Turnadaily Hill still knocks the breath out of me, and Mike McGuff is still a giant of a man, though I haven't seen him in a few weeks.
When I heard that hardware shops could open again as the current restrictions begin to ease, I tried to conjure up an image of where the hardware shops in my current locality of Cork are, and I discovered that I knew of none, at least none that answered to my image of a hardware shop. Nowadays, apparently, it's somewhere like Woody's or B&Q, but they're DIY shops, surely. No, for me a hardware shop is a roomy emporium in an Irish town that sells everything from a needle to an anchor, or thereabouts. And it's epitomised for me by Betty Blaine's shop opposite the house where I grew up in Ardra, County Donegal. Betty's shop sold everything. Two long counters ran down the length of the building, the one grocery, the other drapery, and somewhere muddled up between the two, you would find the hardware range of needles and anchors and everything in between. At the back of the shop, hidden from sight by the tall bread cupboards, was a pile of empty boxes, thrown casually into concealment. And at the back of that again, a real treasure trove. Big wooden tea chests with silver paper lining, full of loose tea leaves from India. India seemed very far away from Ardra then. The tea chest always had a little scoop inside and a stack of plain, sturdy brown paper bags. And because I was Betty's treasured neighbour, I was allowed to fill the bags with half a pound of tea each, and then bring it to Betty, who would weigh it on the big scales in the grocery part of the shop before it was stashed away on a shelf. Most of the business was done on the grocery side. Big hams and cuts of fatty bacon that would be sliced by hand with a sturdy knife, then weighed on the same big scales as the tea. You wouldn't believe what was weighed on those scales. When I was born, we didn't have our own bathroom scales at home, and new babies had to have their weight checked regularly. Yes, you're imagining it perfectly. Betty would go to the back of the shop where the empty cardboard boxes were chucked and invariably end up with an empty butter box. My little frame was gently placed inside, and up on the scales I went. 8 pounds, 2 ounces. Sure, I was no more than the weight of a half a stone of spuds. Months went by, and the monthly weigh-ins went on too, I suppose until I grew out of the grocery weighing scales. But the image and the experience stuck. In years to come, and especially when I became a fairly well-known name in RTE, Betty would always lay special claim to her relationship with me. She would say, "Sure, I knew that one, since I used to weigh her in the butter box." There was no Brussels directive on health and safety in the 50s in Donegal. We did what was practical and necessary. And look at us now. We live to tell the tale. Those early years rolled gently by, until one day when I was 6 years old, Betty's grocery, drapery and hardware shop performed another vital role in my life. It was a dreary afternoon in November, and my father took me for a walk after school around 4 o'clock with our dog Spot. A bit later we were back home when there was a sudden flurry of activity. My father had taken ill. The house was in a panic, and I was dispatched to Betty's shop. I remember Betty taking me in her arms, sitting at the fire in the grocery side. "Your daddy's very sick." And then I remember how over and over as the evening wore on, she would run out of the shop and the shop bell would tinkle before she ran across the road to check on how my father was faring. For a few times, her report was the same. "Your daddy's very sick." And the shop bell would tinkle again as she played the role of messenger once more. But then the bell stopped. Betty, the loving messenger, had made the final trip. This time she held me tighter in her arms. "Your daddy's gone to heaven," she said. And my life changed forever. Yes, the grocery, drapery and hardware shops were a different entity back then. Different rules, or no rules as we know them now. The hardware shops of today are still a mystery to me. I think it's a misnomer, really. But then, there's no shop in the world that can ever occupy a place in my heart as Betty Blaine's grocery, drapery and hardware shop.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Play's the Thing by Colin Murphy. Missing Italian 90 was by Pat Hanratty. The Heron Is Present was by Aoife Barry. That was The River by Leo Morin. and Betty Blaine's Hardware Shop was by B.B. Baskin. The music on the programme was Cole Porter's song Brush Up Your Shakespeare from Kiss Me Kate, sung by Keenan Wynn and James Whitmore. Put 'Em Under Pressure by the Republic of Ireland Football Squad. The Soul Serene was by Villagers. And finally, The Saw Doctors N17. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.